Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFPU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk hockey and beer, among other things. A new spring and summer course began this week on why hockey is so deeply ingrained in Canadian culture. We'll talk to the instructor. We'll hear from a Brock Medical Science student about a research study project carried out recently with a group of downtown St. Catharines seniors in order to assess the age friendliness of the downtown core. And we hear from a couple of young Pelham entrepreneurs, one of whom is a student at the Goodman School of Business. They've started up their own craft beer business here in Niagara. From beer to ice, to beer on ice, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. Well, it's the first week of May, and people are talking about hockey, of course. The quest for Lord Stanley's mug is underway, and although no local teams are doing the playoff dance this year, there's still quite a bit of interest in the game around Niagara and beyond. So it should come as no surprise, a course on hockey in Canada is part of the spring and summer course offerings at Brock. The course, Analysis of the Sports Industry, Canadian Hockey, is an offering of the Applied Health Sciences Sport Management Department, and the instructor again this year is Jordan Chiron. He's a self-proclaimed hockey nut, but he says you don't necessarily have to share that passion in order to get something out of the course yourself. Beyond the fan aspect of the game, Jordan told me on the phone this past weekend, the course runs far deeper than that.
Offered for a few years here at Brock, and I taught it a couple of years ago in the fall. So they've offered it in the spring a few years ago, but it's just a great offering to have in the spring as well.
Now, are you yourself a hockey nut?
Yeah, I've been in love with hockey since I was about 3 years old, so it's a great compliment to my life.
Other people, when they teach courses, they've got a PhD in something, or they write their thesis on a particular topic that they're teaching on. I'm not quite sure you could do a PhD on hockey, though.
Oh, you could definitely do a PhD in hockey. Hockey's been embedded in our culture since the foundation of Canada, basically. So there's more material than most people think of. And hockey's basically a definition in many ways of who we are as Canadians.
Well, that's true. Now, you're not just talking about the day-to-day goings-on in hockey. I suspect you're probably looking more at, if you will, the heritage or the history of hockey?
Well, the course looks at definitely the heritage of hockey and the core kind of cultural aspects of hockey, but it also kind of does touch on the day-to-day aspects and kind of snapshots of basically the more current events of it as well.
Well, speaking of current events, as we've seen just recently, racism has reared its ugly head in the current Stanley Cup finals are underway. That's not new, though, is it?
No, it's definitely not. It's something that's kind of been embedded in the game as it's gone along, but unfortunately it keeps creeping its head into the game as we keep going on.
So is that something you touch on during the course?
Definitely. It's something that we go along and we look at something actually. We're looking at how residential schools played a part in the development of the game.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate aspect of the game, and I guess for someone like myself who doesn't really follow the game that closely, we look at it and we say, how can you get so involved in a sport that you resort to racism in order to make a point? It makes no sense.
Yeah, it really doesn't, but unfortunately it's kind of something that touches on the sport, and I think kind of how definitely the Boston Bruins handled it recently was really a classy way that the organization handled it and showed a lot of class from that organization's standpoint.
Yeah, very true. The other recent aspect of current events that I thought was particularly telling of our society today, and this goes to the Toronto Maple Leafs, when James Reimer was having that bad streak, I think it was, what, about 8 games, and people were tweeting to his wife about how lousy a job he was doing. First of all, you've got to look at that as being cowardly. And second of all, what's the point? What good can come of doing that? I mean, it's not her problem.
Well, I mean, we as Canadians take hockey as a little more than just entertainment in some ways, and it's something we take almost personally, but unfortunately we have a little bit of a difficulty detaching it as just something as entertainment. But it is a difficulty that we struggle with.
Yeah, and I wonder how much social media comes into play here, because there used to be a time when you would, say, call a radio station phone-in program on sports, or you would write a letter to the editor of the local paper, and that was about it. Or you would talk to people around the water cooler. Now you've got a ready-made audience for whatever you want to vent upon, especially in the world of sports.
Definitely. That's something we address actually in the course, is kind of the changing aspects of the game and how kind of the game is evolving with technology, and how actually with Sportsnet taking on the new developments with the new broadcast deals. And one of the big aspects that Sportsnet sold on with the new broadcast deal is that they want to take broadcasting to the next level with that. So that'll be a new piece, and it'll be interesting to see how Sportsnet develops with the new broadcast deal that they did sign.
Yeah, and that, of course, makes people wonder just what comes of Hockey Night in Canada.
Yeah, Hockey Night in Canada. So they do have some mechanisms in place to kind of preserve that for at least the next few years, but the long-term future of that will be interesting to see.
And you also wonder if in the meantime it's just going to become a shadow of its former self. It's not going to have the prestige that I suspect it once did.
Yeah, we can hope that it does remain, but time will tell to see what the future of that kind of institution of Canadian history will see.
Now, I asked off the top, if you are a hockey nut, and you are, self-professed, do people in the course who take the course have to be that way, or is that more of a hindrance?
Actually, I think in some ways it's a hindrance, and one of the things I kind of outline in the first class is kind of check your allegiance at the door, so to speak. It's a good thing to have a passion for hockey, but it's also not a necessary aspect of it. One of the things that kind of holds some people back is their allegiance. So it's good to come in with an open mind to it. So I definitely presenting material. Unfortunately, some days I'm a Buffalo Sabres fan, which isn't necessarily a good thing the past few years. So you definitely want to come in with a passion for the sport, but in no way is it a necessity.
See, for myself, I tend to look at hockey as an outsider. So I don't go into it as a fan, per se. I don't follow any particular team, and I'm constantly bemused, for example, by fans of any particular Major League hockey team who get so wrapped up in it that they can't see from the outside the factors that come into play here. Nothing else seems to matter. The team is it. And I find that fascinating that people can get that wrapped up in a game.
Yeah, I think the outsider's perspective is actually sometimes some of the most valuable perspective, because they can bring that extra clarity to it and take the emotion outside and kind of say, wait a second, guys, take a look at what you're really saying. You're saying something with emotion and not with clarity. So someone like yourself is really valuable when we're discussing kind of day-to-day aspects and even historical aspects within the classroom. So if we take an issue like concussions or fighting or something like that. So when we go through something like, should fighting still be part of the game of hockey? Someone that's coming in with an outsider's perspective can really bring a different approach in and say, maybe fighting shouldn't be part of hockey, and present a very different perspective to that. And it's a really valuable perspective.
Well, thank you for that. I'll remember that comment and replay it the next time I have a conversation about hockey with someone who will come up and say, you have no idea what you're talking about. Let's talk about some of the historic aspects of the game, because you tend to go through, I guess, in the course, decade by decade. You're looking at the history of the game up to what we know today about hockey.
Correct. So we look at things kind of like the Canadian Amateur Hockey Association and kind of the role that it played. So, I mean, it started back at the turn of the century, and how it developed and how kind of associations like it led to what we know as the NHL today. So it's interesting, and a lot of the students kind of go in and they just kind of look at the NHL as they know it, but there was a lot of key associations and developments along the way that led into developing the game that we know today.
Yeah, like I like one of your quotes here I'm reading. We forget a lot happened before 1995. That's a telling comment, because I guess for the current generation, a lot of people, 1995 is kind of like the defining moment of before that, internet was not as pervasive, for one thing. And a couple of years before 1995, the Montreal Canadiens won the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, and they kind of go, oh, okay, that was when it all kind of started for them. It'd be 1993 for some of them when the Montreal Canadiens won the Cup, or they look at, oh, what happened before Wayne Gretzky, or different pivotal moments along the way.
Yeah, and speaking of Montreal, I would imagine at some point during your course you're going to have to address the infamous Rocket Richard riots in Montreal back in the 50s.
Definitely. So we look at a number of kind of pivotal moments within kind of Canadian hockey history. So the Maurice Richard riots would be one of it. The 72 Summit Series would be another kind of pivotal piece along the way. So there's different snapshots that we look at. Unfortunately, we can't do all of the different pieces along, but we try and take the different snapshots that kind of happen in the key kind of areas along the way.
Yeah, because in Canada, both amateur and professional hockey has such a long and rich history, you couldn't possibly cover it all.
No, it'd be amazing if we could, but like you said, it's such a long and kind of rich history that we've had as a country within the game, and we do our best to kind of find the different snapshots and key aspects along it.
What is it about hockey that gets Canadians so, if you'll pardon the expression, inflamed? And I'm asking this because, for example, with the recent Olympics, I wondered for a while there if Canadians would even notice if every other sport in the Olympics were eliminated, and the only part that was left was hockey.
In my own opinion, I think it's success. I think it's that we've had success, but we've also had failure. And I think as a nation, when you've seen success, and then you've also seen failure. So I know for me personally and my generation, we grew up, and the first kind of failure that we saw was the Nagano Olympics. So we saw the best of kind of our generation go over and experience that failure. And then we also kind of experience the success of the Salt Lake City Olympics. So we've seen the failure and we've seen the success. So now we get so caught up in what it feels like to experience that success. So I think we know the ups and we know the downs. So that's what really kind of lights the fire within our nation.
We touched briefly on social media and sport and hockey in particular. How has technology changed the game for you, do you think?
I think it's the connectivity. I think basically when we want to know what the score is, we can find out what the score is. So like you alluded to earlier, it used to be you had to read what the score was in the newspaper the next day unless you were willing to stay up. Hmm. And you couldn't always basically watch every game. Right now, if you're willing to, you can flip to the various different games that are on different channels. So on TSN you can watch one game, on CBC you can watch another game. A number of years ago you weren't able to do that. Now you can, and that's completely revolutionized your ability to connect with different teams. And you can very easily become a fan of the Mighty Ducks, the Ducks now, but or the Avalanche or the Calgary Flames. It's just accessibility to the game is very different than it was a number of years ago.
And with technology being the way it is now, it's within the realm of possibility. If you are a really diverse and diehard sports fan, you could have several TVs on in your home at the same time, catching signals from so many different providers, watching so many different games at the same time.
Exactly. And with the evolution of fantasy sports, I think you're finding people are becoming more a fan of a player necessarily than a fan of a team. So fantasy sports is really changing that. So you're finding when your team's eliminated, you're becoming a fan of a player and you're following that player that's connected to a team, not necessarily that entire team.
You cover a lot of ground during the course. What wouldn't you be covering?
We do our best, or I do my best to cover as much as I can, but I think there's aspects kind of the history of the game that we scrape over that we can't always dive into deep enough. We touch on the early history of the game, but we don't really go into the depths of the early history of the game. So we may spend kind of a class or two on the early history of the game, but you could spend basically an entire course just looking at the early history and how the game developed, the technology of the game developing. We only spend a couple classes on that. You could also spend an entire class just on the issues of the day and talking about how the rules are developing and how the rules are changing. So we're looking more at snapshots of the game versus diving really deep into the different issues.
You mentioned off the top that you're supposed to check your allegiance at the door when you come in for the classes. I'm just curious if people actually come in wearing their favorite team's jersey or not.
Last time I taught the course, there definitely wasn't, because the strike was on.
Oh, that's right.
Challenge.
Yes. Yeah.
So the NHL strike was on, but this time I'm expecting that there will be a few people, especially with the Montreal Canadiens still being in the playoffs, that there'll be a few Canadiens fans wearing their jerseys.
You know, you realize that you're teaching the course in the evening when there's a lot of hockey games on.
Yeah, definitely. So during the break, I'm expecting a few students to be checking this course as quickly as they can.
Which, again, they could not do a few years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah. Jordan, thank you very much for your time. I know you're very busy and you've got a million things on your plate, but I appreciate you taking time to talk to us today about it.
Not a problem.
And that was Jordan Chiron, the instructor teaching the spring and summer course on Canadian hockey at Brock through to June the 13th. The course is entitled Analysis of the Sports Industry, Canadian Hockey, and the course began this week. Last October on Inquisitive Minds, we talked with Paula Gardner, a course instructor and assistant professor of health sciences at Brock, about a webinar she was involved with dealing with the aging population and how we can make our surroundings more age-friendly. Lately, Paula and her team of student researchers have been involved in an intergenerational research study project that matched students with 20 Niagara seniors to better understand what makes a community age-friendly. Their findings are released in a study entitled Through Their Eyes, which examined the age-friendliness of the neighborhood surroundings in Niagara Region's senior residence on Center Street in downtown St. Catharines. Elisa Brown, a third-year Brock Medical Sciences student, took part in the study and joined us in our CFBU-FM studios recently to discuss the study and their findings. I asked Elisa if what she saw opened her eyes at all about how age-friendly our world actually is.
Definitely. There were quite a few steps in the process that led to the gained perspective. Paula had us in class have a simulation where we took time to kind of see how it was to age. So we had the use of a walker with hard beans in our shoes, and we had her tape our fingers together with gloves on and try to do day-to-day things. So that was the kind of beginning stages of learning what this perspective was of how age-friendly St. Catharines really is. And to be able to gain that perspective, you have to kind of walk in their shoes. And it was very interesting to be in a wheelchair and see some people hold the door open for me and other people wonder, what's wrong with her? Why is she in that wheelchair? She looks perfectly normal to me. And to have that kind of understanding of this is what physiologically it feels like, and the restrictions are minimal because I can, you know, get up out of the wheelchair or I can open the door for myself. But to have even that hour of seeing what it was like was quite amazing, and nothing that I'd ever done in the science classroom before, so it was different.
So this is basically, you would have been doing this to learn before you get out there in the
field. Exactly.
So you have a better understanding of what the seniors in particular are going through.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was the first step of the perspective. And then from there, we went out into the community and we conducted our research and our interviews. And from that, we collected a lot of information from various sources, some that were very pleased with the way that St. Catharines is as a city and felt there was a strong sense of community. And then others had, you know, slight problems or felt a little bit isolated, especially during the winter time, and just gaining those different perspectives was something that started in the classroom, but then we were able to develop outside of the classroom. So
So what was the time frame you were working on? This was over this, obviously, this past winter? So you would have been experiencing this wonderful, glorious Niagara winter.
It was wonderful. And Paula mentioned, you know, it would have been nice to have this weather now, but we did have a lot of snow, a lot of wet and icy conditions when we went out. So when we started the interview process, it was around March, I believe, that we started the interview processes and various weather conditions, and just really seeing how the roads, you don't really understand or notice that bump in the sidewalk for you is very easy to maneuver. But when you're on a scooter or have a walker, it's that much more challenging. So it was kind of interesting to have the weather element play into it as well.
And that's something that I think a lot of people do tend to forget. As difficult as it is for us to negotiate the winter, it's especially difficult for the seniors who are using a walker or, as you say, a scooter or a wheelchair or something like that. It's much more difficult for them. We're walking. Mm-hmm. With them, it's just an entirely different set of parameters that they have to deal with. And with all the snow and the ice that we had this year, makes it especially difficult for them.
Yes, definitely. And even the wear that the cold causes on the sidewalk, just up here at the corner, I think of James and King, there is, you know, trees that have grown and the roots have kind of shifted the cement work a little bit, and there's a little bit of a bubble around the trees. That bubble is then exaggerated in the wintertime when you have a narrow space to get through. And if you're not careful, you can overturn your scooter if you're going over that because it's so steep. So it's the care that we don't necessarily see every day that we wouldn't know that there's a complication there. But when you are out with the individual, it was quite interesting to pay attention to those small details.
Now, when you were out in the field, as it were, with the seniors, were you at all surprised by what you saw when you were spending time with them?
I wouldn't say that I was surprised. I think that for myself, it was definitely different to see what they enjoyed. From a younger perspective, we're often caught up in the media and we're caught up in keeping to ourselves, I find, a lot more. And for them, it's community that is what keeps them going. And it's that interaction at the mailbox, it's that interaction at the coffee shop that perpetuates their happiness. And for me, that was surprising in a way, but it was really nice to see that as well and value that and to gain value from that. It's not always the text message that is the friend. It's the face-to-face time that keeps you happy. And so I think that in my going out, just little details like that were quite interesting to see and getting perspective from.
Yeah, because for a lot of them, that's their social network.
Exactly.
Going to the post office box, mm-hmm. picking up their mail.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, when they meet at dinner, for example, or something like that, they don't have that human contact.
Exactly.
What did you learn? What did you take away from the study yourself?
From the study myself, there were quite a few points that I learned. I journaled all of them, which is a part of the qualitative research, is you're expected to kind of keep a journal of things that you're learning either academically, things that you're learning out in the field, and then personal reflection. So from the experience, one thing that, you know, kind of struck out to me was, first of all, safety. So you have a reckless driver who is speeding to a stop sign, and they think that that action only affects them, but they don't see the person that's trying to walk the street and that fear that it inflicts on that person and the lack of security that they find in that moment. And that continued pattern or habit that is found with someone who's on their cell phone driving recklessly, it instills a viewpoint on life for someone else that may have a mobility issue. So that was one thing that I found really interesting, was the fear that sometimes was felt even in going out just because of someone else's carelessness. And you think, oh, I came to that stop sign rather quickly and, oh, shouldn't do that. But you don't really necessarily understand who else is affected by even those small things. So that was one thing that was really interesting for me. And then another thing that I would probably say that I learned from the experience is that just in the qualitative research, how you can't just kind of sit back and observe. You really have to be engaged in the time that you're spending with the people. And a lot of times we can look at a situation and see how we would take it. But when you're in the qualitative research and you're interacting with the seniors and you're able to ask them further questions and you're able to observe and be active in that observation, that was something that I never had experienced before. So that was a really interesting academic side of things was just learning how to interact and gain knowledge from that interaction as opposed to just observing. So that was something that was really cool. And then just this, the things that we take for granted, so the transportation system here in St. Catharines, learning how people do really rely on it, or learning how it's really difficult for people to go all the way up to Geneva and go to the store there. It's quite a stretch. And if they want to, they can take the bus. But then, you know, bringing back those groceries is quite difficult. So then they have to spend $20 on a cab home, and they're on a fixed income, and that's not, you know, a suitable situation for them. Or even the location of the building at 14 Center Street was across from the Raft, and some seniors found it difficult and didn't feel safe going out because of the younger crowd that was there. And so you take this all into perspective and you say, what can I do with this information? And I think that even the learning experience of being open to another perspective is a learning experience in itself, whether you feel like you can do anything or not. Just that gained knowledge of what someone else thinks of your neighborhood or someone else thinks of your city is something that I don't think you get without that interaction. So that was really valuable.
Now, you mentioned the 14 Center Street location. That's where you were actually doing your study research.
Yes, yes.
So how many students were involved in the research?
There was about 45 of us.
Wow.
I believe. I'm not 100% certain on the numbers, but it was around that.
But more than a few.
Yeah, more than a few. We were paired with 20 seniors.
Were you all there at one time, or were you, some would be there some days, some would be there other days?
It was staggered. So we did the interviews. I was in a group with two other girls, so there was three of us, and we scheduled our own interviews. We did a preliminary, so we met with our lady. She was so sweet. We met with her and kind of got to know her a little bit, got comfortable with her, and then we performed a secondary interview that was much longer, and we went out into the community with her, and she showed us what kind of a day in the world of her looked like. And then we went back to her house and asked her some questions and were able to gather information from those questions that were prepared for us.
So you were doing the research by way of interviews, but also actually experiencing firsthand what they experienced on a day-to-day basis.
Yes.
Were the seniors appreciative of you being there? Did they see the value in what you were doing with this study?
Yes, I think at first there was a little bit of apprehension because they weren't fully understanding of maybe what was going to happen or what the outcomes were, or you can try to explain it, but until you experience it, you don't really get the full effect. So I think that there was a little bit of timidity at first, but I think the one thing that was really noted was these students care. And they're interested in our perspective. And a lot of times the elderly can have an opinion of students or teenagers or what have you, our age group, that is sometimes painted negatively. So to kind of write that was something that I think they found a value in, just being able to express what they do on a day-to-day basis and the struggles that they have. I mean, we have seen change. I went back to visit the girl that I was sitting down with, and she mentioned that they had these seats at the entrance of each floor to the elevator, and they were kind of like a picnic bench, and they were too wide for them to back out of or get into. They had to maneuver around it. So Niagara Public Housing took away one of the planks and shortened it. And she said, it's so much easier to get on the elevator now. And it's something so small and so medial, but to her, that makes getting on and off the elevator so much easier. And it was such a small kind of fix that they were able to implement.
And the bench would have been designed and put in place by people who wouldn't have thought, this does not work for these seniors in the present circumstances.
Yeah.
So this is a way that with your research and being out there firsthand and seeing what life is like for them, we as a society can help to improve the lives on a day-to-day basis for the seniors and other people as well.
Definitely.
Who really need help getting around and doing things on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I think that without, you know, consultation, you can make change, but if it doesn't benefit the person, then what was the point? So coming to the grassroots and learning that collaboration is the best way to identify change is something that I think that everyone can profit from.
So is that on every level? I mean, individuals, we can do things. Governments can do their part. Society as a whole. In other words, we better understand the needs that people face in a situation like this. And that makes it so much more easier for us to accommodate them and make their life better.
Mm-hmm. I think it can be done at every level, and I think that teaming together and not just looking at a certain age group, but collectively looking at each generation, it brings a whole new perspective into change. And I know when you turn 18, you can vote, and you can have your say in that. And I think that when we come of a certain age, we maybe shirk our responsibility, but I think that the younger generation, right through to the older generation, have valuable insight in what works and what doesn't, and can bring perspective into all sorts of things. So
years ago, I moved to St. Catharines in 1981, and shortly after that, I took part in a program downtown. We were all put in wheelchairs, and we were told, I remember vividly, we were at the corner of King and Queen near the two banks, and we were expected to negotiate the sidewalks and go, say, from one corner across the street to the other corner. Now, back in those days, that was before it was common practice to lower or eliminate the curbs at the corners. The curbs were all there. And the first thing you realized, you wouldn't think when you're walking, you get to the corner, how do you get your wheelchair down mm-hmm. and across the street and up the curb on the other side?
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, it didn't take long for people to realize we have to do something about that. And now it's common practice that curbs are either lowered or eliminated completely in strategic locations such as intersection corners.
Mm-hmm.
That's the case where when you realize the obstacle, it takes a little bit of thought, a little bit of foresight, but changes that can make a fundamental difference in the lives of so many
mm-hmm.
can happen. And it doesn't take much to make it happen.
No, and for example, when we were out, we went to one store location and there wasn't a handicap button for her to press to open the door. And I know that St. Catharines downtown core is a lot of older buildings, and maybe they didn't necessarily come with that automated service, but if we hadn't have been there, she wouldn't have been able to open that door. And so make it a bylaw. Everything has to be accessible. Every store that they want to go into has to have either an automatic button or automatic sensors. And it's very rudimental. It's not very difficult to do, but especially in the downtown core, with there being so many buildings in this area that are senior housing, I think that it should be expected and regulated, and at this point isn't.
Do you plan to do any more research on this topic while you're at Brock, or is this the study, it's done, we move on to something else?
I personally hope to be involved in this project further. Living in St. Catharines, I think that it's a great opportunity not only to learn, but to implement what I'm learning outside of the classroom. So I do believe that Dr. Gardner has plans to either further this research, because this is her field of expertise. And if that's the case, I would definitely love to help out with it. And I do believe that one thing that we kind of focus on in the classroom is in New York City, they realize that the key to a happy city is to make sure our elderly are happy. And I think that taking that model of living that they've implemented in New York City and seeing how it's worked for them, how it hasn't worked for them, and how we as a younger generation can better the environment for our parents. Because my parents are going to be seniors in more time, less at time than I know, right? So I think that creating opportunities now for myself to be involved, I'm really excited for that.
Now, your study at Brock is centering on more medical topics, right?
Correct, yes.
You finished your third year?
Yes, I'm finished my third year now.
So where do you go from here?
From here, I'm hoping to go into research. I have one more year left. And the nice thing about Brock is they do have mandatory classes that are more science-based, are more math-based, but they do have options to kind of see where your niche is. And so this semester in particular has been finding my niche and what really interests me. And I've found particular interest in quantitative and qualitative research. I love biostatistics, even though if you ask some students at Brock, they wouldn't agree. But for me, as a student, I really want to know where I can help out and what tools I need in my tool belt to do that. And you can't have one subject and ignore another and not explore all your options. And I think when you're younger, you can explore all your options. You can you can look in the different areas of research and the different skill sets that are needed. And it's kind of scary at first because there's a lot out there, but I've really enjoyed the pursuit of my knowledge and where it's taken me. So I'm hoping to get my master's. I'm not 100% sure what yet. I've always said I wanted to be an epidemiologist. However, doing these qualitative research classes has shown me another side of scientific research that is more socially based, but it can affect change at a grassroots level as opposed to more of a scientific measurement level. So just trying to see where I fit in.
I've talked to a lot of students at Brock who find that when they start, they're not quite sure what they want to do. But at some point, the proverbial light bulb goes off over their head and they realize, this is my calling.
Mm-hmm.
This is my interest, and this is where I feel I can make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
That's not unusual, I gather, that's by, say, the third year, for example, everything has coalesced for you and you realize, this is where I want to be and this is the direction I want to take my education.
Exactly. I mean, you can go into your education and expect one thing. I think even at a high school level, everyone says they want to be a firefighter or they want to be an astronaut or a doctor. And then you get into the organic chemistry class and you're like, oh, maybe I'm going to second guess that thought. So I think for me, just being able to have the opportunity to study under professors like Professor Gardner, who really do want you to succeed and learn as much as you can, not just in the knowledge side of things, but the practical application side of things, has been really instrumental in kind of solidifying, this is the direction I want to go in. And they make human contact with you, and they're not just a talking head at the front of the classroom. They're invested and interested in your future. And that's something that I've really appreciated about Brock. I started my educational pursuit at a larger university in engineering, and it was much, much different than what I found here in Niagara, and I really do value the human aspect of Brock.
So where do you think you'll be in 10 years?
In 10 years, oh my goodness, it's hard to say. I could see myself working for a public health and working in the research side of what they need to do in a community level. I see myself across the world, and I think it's really great to have an open mind and to not limit myself at this point, because I'm so young that any opportunity that presents itself, I really don't want to say no or that's not an option. So it could be Niagara, it could be Toronto, it could be Africa. I have no idea. I have no clear vision for the future, because at this point I'm just focusing on keeping my marks up.
And you never say never.
Exactly.
Elise, we thank you very much for your time, and best of luck and congratulations on a study well done.
Wonderful.
You and your colleagues.
Thank you so much for your time.
That was Elise Brown, a third-year medical sciences student who took part in a study entitled Through Their Eyes, which examined the age friendliness of the neighborhood surrounding a senior's residence in downtown St. Catharines. The course instructor was Paula Gardner, an assistant professor in health sciences at Brock University. We've talked on the show in recent weeks about tea and wine and the health benefits of both, but today we're going to talk about another beverage popular at this time of the year, beer. Now, I'm not quite sure what the health benefits of beer might happen to be, if any, but for many, it is a feel-good beverage of choice. Enter twin brothers Colton and Asa Prevost of Font Hill. Colton is a third-year BBA co-op student at the Goodman School of Business, who, along with his brother, has followed his passion for craft beer and started their own brewing company. At their April 19th release party, one of their beers sold out in 3 hours, so they seem to be on to something here. Since the Goodman School of Business is all about fostering entrepreneurship, I thought it would be fun to spend a few moments with Colton and Asa and find out about their fledgling craft beer business. I asked them first when the seed for a craft beer company first came to them.
The whole idea kind of stemmed when we were in grade 12 at Il Crosley Secondary School. We were together on a project in our business class, and we had to choose an industry and do a project on corporate social responsibility. We didn't really know much about the brewing industry specifically, but we had chosen that because we thought it could be fun. We had done some home brewing and kind of wanted to look into, you know, how big breweries do it. And then that was when we were exposed to the craft industry, and we instantly fell in love with what people were doing, like all the fun stuff that you can do, but, you know, still be in the industry.
Craft beers are an entirely different entity from what we term so-called big boys in the industry. Mm-hmm. But it's really growing right now. It's filling a niche. And I guess that's a nice place for you to be, not only just to start out, but to develop your business, because it is a growing part of the market.
Yeah, I mean, currently craft beer only represents 1% of beer sold in Ontario, but it's growing. I mean, every year in the LCBO specifically, we have closer to 10%, and we gain a few percent every year, whereas the big boys, so-called, they lose a couple percent every year. So you really are seeing the shift of people trying new products, trying craft beer, liking it, and it's kind of exponentially shifting over. So,
are we becoming beer snobs then? We're not willing to satisfy our palate with what our parents and grandparents were happy with. We want something a little bit more now?
Some of us. I mean, I feel in general, people nowadays are really trying to try new things, and people are really trying to get new experiences, and that's sort of where craft comes into play. I mean, it's new, but it's old because it's the way beer used to be brewed, so it's sort of a nice opportunity for a grassroots movement that are kind of really taking shape right now.
But that being said, a craft beer industry is every bit as intricate and complicated, if you will, as a larger beer enterprise, if you will. There's just as much work involved. I guess the output is just smaller.
Exactly. I mean, but you get the chance to have more fun with it. I mean, larger industries, they have to look at every single thing that they do to back up their brand. There's a lot more politics in what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Whereas with some, like the smaller guys, we can do fun stuff. We can brew different beers and then never brew them again if we want to. It's a big decision when they come out with a new beer because it's got to back their brand. It's got to be successful, and it costs them a lot more money to do more interesting things. So on a smaller scale, it allows us really to be more creative without the hassle, but it's still a lot of work.
Yeah, but you're able to turn on a dime, as it were.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. So if someone says, could you brew up a particular beer to promote such and such?
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, you could do that.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is something that others can't do. I remember growing up in Toronto when my father made his own beer in the basement. This was an ongoing thing for many years. I remember it being pretty potent stuff, and it didn't take long for all of our friends in the neighborhood to discover this particular fact, so that's why our house was always the most popular house on the street. How different is craft beer, the actual makeup of craft beer, from what you typically would buy from the stores?
The difference with craft beer is that it doesn't, I mean, there's no preservatives. It's more natural. The big guys tend to use a lot of what are called adjuncts, so they use corn and they use rice in their beer to essentially make it go further. So by doing that, you get a more watered-down product that's more easy drinking, but it's less beer-like. So after that being promoted for so many years and getting bigger and bigger, people have kind of lost what real beer tastes like. So the craft movement is really bringing back to, hey, this is what beer started as. This is what beer is. It's not filled with corn. It's not watered down. It's made up of traditionally four ingredients.
A more genuine product.
A more genuine, that's for sure.
Well, Niagara College is well known now for their craft beer program, and Asa, you can speak about this. I toured their facilities a few years ago. Would you like to see something like that, maybe even on a smaller scale, develop at Brock, or is that really out of the question?
I'd love to see a brew program be developed at Brock, even if it was something more along the lines of brew business sort of thing. There's more that goes into the brewing industry than just the actual brewing. So if Niagara College could focus on training people on how to brew the product, and then Brock had a program geared more towards the business of brewing and the marketing involved with it, the laws involved with it, the licensing, like everything involved in actually having a brewing company, I think that paired with Niagara College's program would be fantastic.
So a partnership, in other words.
A partnership would really be ideal, yeah. If they could have a joint program, it would be.
They both do something similar in the viticulture industry.
Yeah.
I mean, they both have very successful viticultural programs. The Niagara College one being more hands-on working in the winery, whereas in the university it's more theoretical, but they both have their place. There's lots of different jobs that are going to be opening up in the industry, especially as small brewers get larger. Not everybody's going to want to be in the brew house brewing like what Niagara College teaches. There's a lot of other positions that open up in management, exactly like what Colton was saying, there's going to be a lot of other jobs in the industry that we can help support.
Now, Asa, you studied at the Niagara College Brewmaster and Brewery Management Program, and Colton was at the Goodman School. You're still at the Goodman School.
Yes.
So I presume that's how you determined who did what role. One's the brewmaster, one's the business brains, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of, as soon as we were thinking about getting into it, we were like, if we really want to make a go of this, we need to be well-rounded. And as far as if we both wanted to take the brewmaster course and then both take a business course, it would take a very long time. It wouldn't be very practical. So we sort of looked at our skills, looked at who would be better at doing what, and sort of thought if either of us take one, then we can sort of teach each other as well. So Asa might be the brewmaster, but he has managed to teach me a lot about brewing, and I've kind of learned through osmosis a lot about it. And him as well. I mean, we've kind of been sharing what we've learned back and forth, brainstorming, making sure we're both knowledgeable on everything. So,
what's the reaction of the powers that be at the Goodman School of Business? When you went to them and you proposed the idea, what was their reaction?
They were very supportive. I mean, I first proposed the idea to a couple teachers who were very supportive, but then when I had the chance to go on a co-op as part of my program, that's where I talked to the co-op department and was like, look, I need a job in the brewing industry. I need a co-op or else it's not really going to be worth it for me. So they were very supportive in contacting all the contacts they had trying to get me a position. I couldn't have asked for more support from them, really.
Now, you're doing the co-op now, as you speak.
Yes.
That's a one-year co-op?
Yeah. So with co-op, you do three terms, usually with different employers. But being that I had such a fantastic opportunity, they allowed me to stay for three terms, so a full year at one location.
What's the danger that where you're doing the co-op, they say, what would it take to get you to stay here? Rather than do what you're doing down there.
Yeah, it is definitely a danger in that they do really want to keep me on, and it's you really have to go back to school, but they have been very supportive of our initiative. They want to see as many people succeed as possible. I mean, the craft brewers that are currently in Ontario, they want Ontario to be a center in North America for craft beer. They want to drive the tourism to Ontario and make it a destination. So it's beneficial for every brewery in Ontario to really support each other. They're kind of viewing us as another person who can help contribute to that initiative.
So where do you go from here? Do you continue to grow the company? And if so, how do you go about it?
We're definitely wanting to continue to grow the company. We're really in the starting sort of proof of concept stage right now, known as contract brewing. So we're not brewing at our own facility yet. We're sort of brewing at another's facility right now, Niagara College, so we can get a product out there, sort of test the market, test the area, make sure what we're going to do works. And then it also allows us to have a product out there and get some cash flow while we actually work to open our own facility.
Obviously, you don't have the wherewithal to have the facilities yourself, so having Niagara College in your own backyard is a great arrangement for you. Do you see the point at some point in the future where you would want to look for investors and invest in your own facility?
Well, that's definitely the long-term goal. We just feel like we need to do it in steps. So currently, right now, we're brewing at Niagara College, but we actually have some small-scale equipment of our own, which eventually, with this Kickstarter that we're promoting, we're hoping we can move this system to a licensed establishment where we can brew on it ourselves on our own equipment, have more volume, and then eventually be able to get enough money to brew larger batches at larger breweries to get into, say, the LCBO, and eventually we would have enough interest in the community to help fund an actual facility. That is really the main end goal, is to open up a real brewing facility in Pelham.
So how much volume are you able to do now? It must be quite limited.
Well, currently, we're actually just brewing 200 liters at a time at the Niagara College on their small-scale pilot systems. Once we get our system up and running, we have the ability to brew about 400 liters. So those are just obviously test batches. Then we're able to supply one pub right now in Fonthill. So we're kind of using that to develop our recipes and have input from the community to pick the beers that they like before we can start brewing them on a larger scale.
I gather you're at the point now where you have to consider putting together a business plan.
We have sort of been in the process of putting together a business plan for a long time. We've sort of changed our minds a couple times about exactly what we wanted to do. So, I mean, anybody that has put together a business plan can tell you that it's never going to be the same. It'll constantly change. But right now, we're just focusing on creating something that we know is going to be more along the lines of what what we're going to be doing. Initially, we had thoughts about opening a brew pub in the area, so that's what we were focusing on, and then our thoughts have sort of changed towards an actual production brewery.
So how much do you rely on what you've learned so far at the Goodman School of Business to help draw up that business plan?
Quite a bit. Goodman's taught me a lot. They've taught me mostly skills. I mean, anyone can tell you that a university degree really teaches you how to learn. So my co-op placement has actually taught me more than anything. Goodman's really given me the opportunity to go there and giving me the skills necessary where I can learn the most there. But being that my co-op placement was at a startup brewery, I've really been able to see every step of the way how they've been doing things. And being that I'm in administration there, I've really been able to see the numbers as well. So I've really been able to have a look at a functioning brewery and know exactly what it takes and what goes into it.
Essentially, on-the-job training is indispensable.
Oh, incredible. It's incredible, yeah.
Now, I was on your Facebook page this morning, as a matter of fact. I did like it. I love your logo, by the way. I think it's a great-looking logo. I see you talked briefly about the Kickstarter campaign. What's it all about, and where do you plan to go with it?
So the Kickstarter campaign basically functions as pledges. So you can go on, and you can pledge any amount, and there's specific amounts that will get you certain rewards. And if we reach our $25,000 goal, then we get the money that you've pledged, and you get...
Yeah, you get the rewards, but it's...
Is it a call to reward?
It's a call to reward. It's an all-or-nothing scenario, though. So if we don't reach $25,000 worth of pledges, your credit cards don't get charged, we don't get anything, you don't get anything, it's all-or-nothing.
But nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Well, we've managed to gain quite a bit of publicity with it. I mean, obviously, we're here talking to you now. We've been published in Ontario Beer News, Canadian Beer News. Now people kind of know that we're out there and we're doing this. The money gained from it would allow us to start brewing more beer at a larger facility quicker. So you'd probably see us at more locations sooner. But it's not going to stop us if we don't reach that $25,000 goal. It's just going to take longer to actually get our product out there. So it really is just a kickstart. It's not a starting point. It's not mandatory, but it would definitely help us bring it to Pelham as soon as possible.
Now, you want to base yourself in Pelham? Or that's just where you are right now, and you'll see where you end up?
Well, we would like to base ourselves in Pelham. Like currently, we're planning on brewing at different breweries that we work at that are outside of Pelham, but the main goal is to bring it all back home.
Yeah, the dream from the beginning has really been to bring a brewery to our hometown. At first, we just thought it would be a really cool, unique thing for Pelham, and then since we had that dream sort of 5 years ago, we've seen breweries starting opening up everywhere, and thankfully none have opened up in Pelham, so that opportunity is still there.
And I'm sure Mayor Dave is going to be very pleased to hear that, you know, that you're working on it. How long does the campaign go till?
It was a 30-day long campaign, so I believe there are 18 days left.
Yeah, probably around there.
Around 18.
So you realize the campaign will end just before the so-called May 2-4 weekend. That's not a coincidence, I gather.
No, I wouldn't say that's coincidence. I'm actually thinking about it the first time since you mentioned it.
Colton, since you're the one who's been to the Goodman School of Business, how important to you was getting into the Goodman School of Business, going through what they taught you, getting that placement, and getting to where you are right now?
Well, without it, where we are right now wouldn't be possible. One thing is that it's the local school. It's allowed me to go to school without spending tons of money. We knew that if we wanted to open up something, we couldn't be in debt when we did it. Mm-hmm. And coincidentally enough, Brock has a great business program, so it was kind of a no-brainer in going there. It's taught me a lot about business. I knew I would have to work in the industry before opening a brewery. It was sort of, we knew that would have to happen. And as an outsider to the industry, the only way I figured I would be able to accomplish that is through an educational placement. So the whole thought of looking at Brock was sort of, okay, they have a business co-op program. I'll go in, I'll learn how to open up a business, and I'll be able to be placed at one. So that'll give me the experience so that maybe as soon as I graduate, we can open up something.
Okay, so you're third year now?
I am, yes.
Okay, so you've got what, one more year to go?
Yep.
Okay, so... So if we say around 2015 sometime, see a new brewery opening up in Pelham, we'll know why.
Exactly. Our whole plan was originally to wait, but we've sort of been looking at the market, been looking how the industry is going, and we've sort of figured now is the time. So that's why we've kind of launched ourselves now. So hopefully before then, you'll see something open up.
Colton and Aza, thank you both very much. Congratulations on your venture. I hope it goes well for you. Also hope the Kickstarter campaign goes well, and we'll look forward to following your careers and see where this takes you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having us. Cheers.
And there we heard from brothers Colton and Aza Prevost of Font Hill, who have launched their own craft beer business in Pelham. And Colton is a student in the Goodman School of Business at Brock. Aza took the Brewmaster and Brewery Management program at Niagara College, and the co-op with a craft beer brewer for Colton will conclude very soon, and then he'll return to Brock for the final year of his education there. They both have good heads on their shoulders, of course, as well as on the product they produce. And that Kickstarter campaign, I think we're now down to about a week. About a week left on that before it wraps up. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. Thank you.